Today. It's going to be, I'm going to give a talk for 30 minutes, essentially an introduction to lucid dreaming. I guess more with a Dharmic edge, because I know that this room will probably have more Dharma practitioners in it than perhaps more of a public talk would do. So lucid dreaming with kind of a more focus on Dharma. Then there'll be a Q&A for half an hour, and then I'll lead a guided meditation, which will be a yoga nidra, so a form of lying down meditation, in which I will, which is great as a standalone relaxation practice, but I'll do it to kind of set ourselves up for lucid dreaming tonight. So I'll be doing some affirmations within the very fertile ground of the hypnagogic state, which should set us up well for some lucid dreaming practice tonight. Okay, so let's begin with our definitions. Aristotle said the definition was the foundation of all understanding. I read that quote recently and I was like, yeah, I'm really into definitions and also etymology. I love to see where words come from. So let's look at this word lucid dreaming. Because etymologically speaking, it's actually quite a complex word and not the perfect word to describe this practice. Because lucid connotes clear seeing, something that is seen clearly, something that is bright, something that elucidates. So people often think that when they're having very bright dreams, very vivid dreams, very well-recalled dreams, that these are lucid dreams. They are unfortunately wrong, but no blame for being wrong on that because of this term. Really, the term should be conscious dreaming, because the defining factor of a lucid dream is conscious awareness within the dreaming sleep state. So if you've ever had a dream where you're sound asleep and within the dream, without physically waking up, you consciously wake up and have what I call the aha moment, the moment of, whoa, recognition. I'm in a dream right now. This is all a dream. I'm inside my mind. That was a lucid dream. So it doesn't matter if it was a nightmare, if it was a sexy dream, if it was a Dharma dream, if it was a horrendous dream. The moment you had that recognition, that aha moment, that, whoa, I'm in a dream right now, you were lucid. Now, of course, very often when we have that moment of recognition, it is so exciting for our psychophysical system that we wake up. Has anybody ever had that where they have become lucid in a dream, then woken up 5 seconds later? Show of hands. Okay, great. Has anybody here had experience of, well, I guess all those people have experience of more than one lucid dream? Great, great. So, a lucid dream is a dream where you know that you're dreaming as the dream is happening, not just a very vivid dream. Most lucid dreams are very vivid. Like the moment you become lucid, it's as if you put on spectacles, or as if you've gone from like normal definition television to like boom, HD, 4K, whatever the highest definition thing is in cinema. Things become very, very bright. But it is also possible to be fully lucid in a dream that is not that vivid. So actually, the vividness of the dream is not dependent on lucidity and vice versa. And the defining factor of lucidity is going, whoa, I'm in a dream right now. So when you have a fully lucid dream, you won't need to ask me whether it was lucid or not. You will know in the moment, wow, I am in a dream right now. My body's asleep in bed. I'm inside a three-dimensional projection of my own mind, a huge virtual reality simulation of my own psychology. And well, let's see. Whoa, I can choose what to do as you fly off that cliff or fly into the air, whatever it is. So in a lucid dream, it's not only defined by its conscious awareness, but it's actually defined by the ability to interact with the dreamscape volitionally. So you have some sort of volitional influence over the dreamscape, which some people call control, and we'll talk about that later. I have a problem with that word, control. So we know what a lucid dream is, a dream where you know that you're dreaming as the dream is happening. Crucially, this awakening of reflective awareness in the dream state is not accompanied by any physiological awakening. So if you want to know what a lucid dreamer looks like when they become lucid, they look like this. There is no outward sign of lucidity. You are still sound asleep, snoring, drooling. You're not in some like meditative, you haven't got your meditation face on. You haven't got your Buddhist meditation face, that one. You're sound asleep. Because dreaming comes at the end of a sleep cycle, right? It's in REM. And we've all heard of those famous 90 to 100 minute sleep cycles. Well, REM comes at the end of your cycle. So by the time you got to a dream period, you are absolutely sound asleep. However, although the body and most of the brain are asleep, part of the brain becomes reactivated and all of your conscious awareness becomes fully reactivated. So although the body is asleep, the mind is fully awake. And of course, a lucid dream is a, from a Dharmic point of view, a great way, a great kind of metaphor to explain awakening. Because in a non-lucid dream state, You believe that things are separate from you. You believe in the duality of the situation. You believe that internally generated things are external and dualistically existing. Once you become lucid, you go, whoa, God, what I thought was outside of me is actually inside of me. These people and trees and cars and space that I thought was dualistically existing and objective reality is actually part and one with my own reality. Very interesting. When we look at the Heart Sutra stuff, like form is emptiness, emptiness is form, which is so over my head in the waking state. No grasp of emptiness or shunyata at all. However, if you have a lucid dream, you get very close to a practical understanding of what that means. Because once you become lucid, oh, I'm dreaming, I'm dreaming. One of the coolest things to do is just tap on a table, just tap, tap, tap on the table. I'm not going to tap because my dogs always bark when I do this bit of the talk, but imagine tap, tap, tap. And the table will feel solid and it will make the noise of solidity in the dream. And yet you know the table is not solid because you know you're asleep. You know you're inside your mind. You know it is made of emptiness. And yet this emptiness manifests as form. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And then within the lucid dream, you can change the way you interact with reality. Like you tap on the table, it will make the noise, it'll feel solid. But if you then in the dream look at the table and say to yourself, speak the truth of emptiness out loud almost, that this table isn't real, it's made of mind, it's empty of inherent existence, then the next time you tap on it, boom, your finger can go through it. And you realize it has no substance. Very, very interesting. And it always shocks me how few. I mean, I can only speak from the Tibetan Buddhist scene here, but how few Tibetan Buddhist lamas use the lucid dream as a metaphor for emptiness and for awakening. When the Buddha was asked, what are you? Are you an angel? Are you a magician? Are you a god? And his answer was, no, I'm awake. What did Buddha wake up from? He woke up from the illusion of dualism. What did he wake up to the truth of oneness? Every time you have a lucid dream, you get a teeny, 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 teeny microdose of that possibility. And the Tibetans would say, once you have enough of those little microdoses, you can have hundreds and thousands of lucid dreams. Eventually, like drops in a bucket, they will overflow into the waking world and you'll have an experience of lucidity in this waking life. I'm still waiting on that, but apparently, drops in a bucket, eh? So we know what a lucid dream is. How does it feel? Really important to talk about how it feels, the kind of felt experience of a lucid dream, because a lot of people assume that a lucid dream is going to be like, I guess it's because of our social reference points, but we assume that a lucid dream will be how a dream is portrayed in a Hollywood movie. They want to show a dream sequence in a Hollywood movie. They'll often go to soft focus, they'll have some dry ice, kind of smoke. And that, as an audience member, that indicates, okay, we're in a flashback sequence here. It goes to grayscale or something like that. I always think with lucid dreams, it is the opposite. Again, like I said, you'd go to this high definition. Colors become so bright in a lucid dream. And time again, when people have their first lucid experience, they'll email me or someone tell me in person, the colors were so bright in the lucid dream. I could see every drop of dew on every blade of grass that was on the floor. I could see every bead of sweat on the person I was looking at. And the smells in the lucid dream, and I smelt a flower in the lucid dream, or I ate an apple in the lucid dream. The sounds I heard in the lucid dream were so loud, were so permeating. For many people, lucid dreaming is not just an experience of an altered reality, it's an experience of hyper reality, which sounds like hyperbole, but stay with me on this. Our experience of reality right now is limited by the five sense organs filtered through the sixth. If you're into this kind of Buddhist thing, the eight consciousnesses, right? You've got the five consciousness, the sixth consciousness, the six consciousnesses, and then the seventh and the eighth. Our experience right now, like my hearing consciousness is limited. I have a perforated eardrum. So I know that I'm not hearing perfectly. My hearing is limited. Some people are wearing glasses here. So your vision, your eye consciousness is absolutely limited in this life, right? We have these limitations of the physical form. Why is it that in the lucid dream you have perfect vision? Why is it in the lucid dream I have perfect hearing? Why is it in the lucid dream, when you taste something, it's like this archetypal taste explosion? Because you're not seeing through your eyes. Your eyes are shut. You're asleep. You're not hearing through your ears. They are not taking in the external world. They are creating sound from within. Of course, this is why lucid dream sex is so seductive for so many people because you're not having an orgasm, you're having a mindgasm, you know, this kind of an internally generated sexual experience. I mean, incredibly seductive, incredibly powerful, in fact. So the lucid dream feels incredibly real. In fact, after a really, really powerful lucid dream, you wake up and kind of start to look at this reality slightly differently, not in a kind of a derealization way, but actually a way of a deeper appreciation of the philosophical tenets of Buddhism, actually. That's exactly what it is. Because the next time you hear people talk about emptiness and the dreamlike nature of reality, once you had a really powerful, fully lucid dream, that becomes much more palatable, becomes much more possible, much less theoretical, and much more, well, I've had lucid dreams as real as this. In fact, I've had lucid dreams where I'm teaching on Zoom, often this bit of the teaching, and then I realize I'm dreaming. And that becomes very meta, very kind of layers of the onion, right? So it feels incredibly powerful. Incredibly powerful. So how does it work? Like, how does lucid dreaming work? Well, it is a learnable skill. You can train yourself to have these experiences. A lot of people have spontaneous lucid dreams. And there were some studies in the kind of early 2000s linking extended periods of mindfulness meditation and other forms of open focus meditation and lucid dreaming. But then actually, a few years ago, a lot of these studies got called into question. And what they now conclude on several, two Harvard studies, is that prolonged periods of meditation don't actually increase people's lucid dream frequency. So doing a lot of meditation does not necessarily give you more lucid dreams than the guy down the street who's not doing a lot of meditation. But it does make your lucid dreams longer. And that makes sense, right? Because if you've cultivated the ability to hold the mind in check, then once you're in a lucid dream on that tightrope of lucidity, where you've got w waking up one side and non-lucidity on the other side, and you're trying to stay on that balance beam of lucidity, it makes sense that if you have cultivated a mindset that can hold form like that, your lucid dreams will be longer. They found actually the thing that increased the frequency of lucid dreams was flow state experiences, close to meditation, but quite different actually. Flow state experiences. Flow is an experience of mind where one enters into a seemingly timeless state where we are both focused and relaxed at the same time. Actually, to talk about flow, the best way is to give examples of some flow state activities. Knitting. No one ever uses this example. It's a great one. People who knit enter into a flow state very quickly. People who play instruments but not reading music, so kind of, you know, freestyle, playing guitar or piano or whatever it might be, enter into flow state. Freestyle rappers, they did a great neurobiological study. They got people to freestyle rap in a fMRI scanner, and they saw the different parts of their brain light up. Dance, of course, is a classic one. You know, free expressive kind of five rhythmsy type dance moves you into a flow state. Rock climbing, this kind of stuff. Flow state activities give you more lucid dreams. So there are ways that people, due to their lifestyle, tend to have more spontaneous lucid dreams than others. But it is a learnable skill, and my job for the past 17 years now has been teaching people how to do that. How? Through guided meditations. A lot of them are like self-hypnosis techniques. The one we'll do today, I'll kind of combine a guided yoga nidra with a kind of self-hypnosis practice too. Some involve certain affirmations, or if you're into Dharma, certain prayers that you do as you're falling asleep. Other techniques involve waking up at certain points in the night when you're more likely to drop into the dream states. So there are ways, the kind of techniques that you can do to induce lucid dreams. But the best technique for becoming lucid is actually age. It's simply being a child, because several studies have shown that children are natural lucid dreamers. Not every child every night. We need to be clear. It's not like every kid you know is lucid dreaming every night. But several studies, two from Harvard and one from the UK, actually, a big study on school children, British school children, has found that lucid dreaming is a natural, spontaneous occurrence of childhood brain development. So lucid dreaming seems to come factory installed. It seems to come factory installed. And I'm always reminded of that wonderful Picasso quote, "Every child is born an artist. The adult's job is to remember how." So too with lucid dreaming. Every child is born a lucid dreamer. The adult's job is to remember how. And it is about remembering. Think of perhaps a language you used to speak as a child, different language to your mother tongue, or the one you speak now, but you no longer speak. And how much easier it would be to recall or remember that language as an adult compared to a language you have never spoken before. You might find this when you, even when you just hear this talk, You might think, yeah, you know, I think I've had that, had these experiences. Something's ringing a bell here. So the first thing is you don't need to learn how to lucid dream. You need to remember. And the second thing to know from this fact about kids having natural lucid dream, being natural lucid dreamers, is that lucid dreaming is natural. It's not some sort of alien imposition that you are forcing upon the unconscious mind. In fact, from a Buddhist point of view, the weird thing is not lucid dreams. The weird thing is non-lucid dreams. Because, of course, the natural capacity of the mind is cognizant awareness. That is the natural state of mind. Your Buddha nature is not strange. Buddha nature is not supernatural, and definitely not superhuman. It is the most normal human facet and the facet of all beings, right? Buddha nature. It's the opposite of original sin. I love sharing stuff on Buddha nature. It's the most optimistic teaching in Buddhism, I think. You know, that you're all born, some teachings say with the seed of awakening, others say actually fully awakened. And that the spiritual path is not a path of becoming enlightened. It's about removing the veils of ignorance that prevent us from seeing and witnessing our already enlightened nature. And when you die, apparently, whether you believe it or not, that nature is revealed to you. And also when you sleep, little flash, but it is possible to recognize that nature when you sleep, apparently. So kids naturally do it. So if you've got any, like adolescents have really long REM periods. If you've got any kids who are like 12 to 16, I'd say that is the prime time to learn lucid dreaming. Very easy time to learn lucid dreaming. Control. Let's look at this, right? Because it is very easy to say that lucid dreaming is dream control. And for those who do say that, again, they're not wrong. I just would say it's not as precise as it could be. So in a lucid dream, you have an element of subjective control over your immediate experience. But to say that you are controlling the dream is to vastly underestimate what you are dealing with, vastly underestimate the power of the dreaming mind. To quote my friend and colleague Robert Wagoner, brilliant lucid dreaming teacher and author, he says, "No sailor controls the sea, so too does no lucid dreamer control the dream." Think what an arrogant sailor would be to say, "I control the sea." No sailor would be so arrogant. They would, their ship will crash very soon. A sailor can sail as if they are in control. A sailor can control their boat. They can navigate their ship, but they're not controlling the sea, right? Exactly the same with lucid dreaming. So tonight, if you become lucid, which many of you will, I wish I could give you a direct percentage, but how many you got? 120? I can't do the percentage on that. So, like, quite a few of you will get lucid tonight. And you'll be amazed. You'll think, oh, I had a spontaneous lucid dream. It wasn't spontaneous. You just spent like a couple of hours, probably before you go to bed, depending what time zone you're on, thinking about this thing that you used to do as a kid. So very natural that you might become lucid tonight. So if you do become lucid tonight and you choose to fly through the sky, because why walk when you can fly? And actually flying in a lucid dream is a prescribed method of doing impossible things, which is one of the stages in Tibetan dream yoga, breaking the rules of the dream, as Mindya Dorje Rinpoche says. When you are flying through the sky tonight and you're going left, you're going right, you're going up, you're going down, you're going, dude, I'm controlling the dream. Charlie was chatting rubbish though. I'm definitely controlling the dream. I want you to ask yourself this: what is controlling the trees that you're whizzing past? What is controlling the feeling of air hitting your face as you zoom through the sky? What's controlling the people? If you're in a populated area in the dream characters will look up and go, oh, wow, just like they would in real life if they saw a human being flying through the sky. Who's controlling them? So, yes, you have an element of subjective control over your immediate experience, but you are no way controlling the dream as a whole. And I think that's a really important attitudinal shift to have, because words are important. In the waking state, and even more so in the dream state, they hold a lot of power. You know, what are words? They are spells. They are things that have an effect on the mind. So don't try and control the dream. Try and befriend the dream. If you think of lucid dreaming as not about dream control, but dream befriending, this is about making friends with that 90% of the iceberg that we usually don't have contact with. Now, if you can befriend that huge capacity that resides within the dreaming mind, if you can befriend the entirety of your unconscious mind, you have a very powerful ally, and you will have more control than you ever thought possible. Not because you have dominated the mind, not because you have subjugated into doing what you want, but because you have made friends with the most powerful part of your mentality, the unconscious mind. So you will be able to do whatever you want in the lucid dream, but not because you've forced it, but because you've made friends and you go, oh, hey, dreaming mind, I would really love to be able to walk through walls. in lucid dream. I'd really love to be able to explore the truth of emptiness in lucid dream. And you will, not because you forced it, because your dreaming mind goes, ah, dude, I've spent my whole lifetime trying to communicate with you. Every night when you go to sleep, based on an 8-hour sleep cycle, you have four or five dream periods. And within those four or five dream periods, I'm writing you letter after letter after letter, trying to communicate. And they're not always mystical letters. Sometimes I'm just writing about what we did in the day today because I'm journaling. But sometimes I want to draw your attention to things that happened in the day and link them to things that happened in the past and fears I have for the future. And this is the intelligence of the dream that I call the dreamer with a big D. And if you can befriend the dreamer, you have a very powerful friend. Let's look at some of the neuroscience on this because it's important. Also, I mean, it is dharmic, really. The Dalai Lama is so into neuroscience. That wonderful quote where he said, if science proves Buddhism wrong, Buddhism must change, not science. That's huge. I mean, you are not seeing that in many other religions. The law of papal infallibility only got changed in 1962, meaning that until 1962, anything any previous pope had said was always gospel. You could not contradict it, which is why, actually, when you look at flat earth and round earth, actually, certain parts of the church only change in 1962 in writing because you couldn't change this. And Dalai Lama saying the opposite, saying, if science proves it wrong, Buddhism must change. So let's look at some of the science here. This is a brain, half a brain. Please, no jokes about where the other half of my brain is. When you are having a normal non-lucid dream, which will still make up the vast majority of your dream experience, even if you manage to get lucid every night of your life, have a lucid dream every night, still around 95% of your dream experience will be non-lucid. 95%, even if you get lucid every night. Why? 8 hours sleep, 4 to 5 dream periods, multiple dreams in each dream period. You do the maths on that. 95% of your dreams are not going to be lucid, right? So don't discount them. We can gain so much benefit from looking at our everyday dreams. So when you're having your everyday dreams, your normal non-lucid dreams, the back part of the brain is highly active. The brain stem, the occipital lobe, the visual cortex, all the kind of back part of the brain is really active. But the front part of the brain, your prefrontal cortex, is almost entirely dormant when you dream. Now, to say that your conscious awareness lives in the prefrontal cortex is ridiculous and is complete scientific reductionism. So I'm not saying that. But it does seem to be that the radio transmitter that kind of transmits conscious awareness does have some link to the prefrontal cortex, because often when that is switched off, we don't have conscious awareness of stuff. So the scientists will say, and they have proved this by getting someone to fall asleep in a brain scanner at Heidelberg University, that when we dream, the back part of the brain is highly active, prefrontal cortex is completely dormant. And because the prefrontal cortex, they say, contains, I would say, helps to transmit our sense of self, our sense of agency, your sense of I am Charlie having experience is all prefrontal cortex. It's all around here, right? So because that is shut down when we dream, that's how you can dream your other people. You ever woke up in the morning and thought, how could I dream that I was a child again? Or how could I dream I was friends with Beyonce? Or how did I dream that I was, a completely different person to who I am? Or how in my dream did my husband not exist? How could I dream in these other universes? Well, because your sense of self was switched off. So most of our dreams are based on memories of who our sense of self was, but sometimes we can be very creative and dream for other people. That's in your everyday dreaming. However, when you become lucid, and you can see this in a brain scan, as soon as the person has the aha moment of, whoa, I'm in a dream right now, the prefrontal cortex lights up like a Christmas tree. You can see this on a brain scan, literally go ping like that. And at that moment, that's when you're going, aha, I am lucid. I am having a lucid dream right now. So we know that lucid dreaming is for real, right? We've got proof of that. Nowadays, the naysayers are just lazy. Just Google it, ask ChatGPT, like, lucid dream science is 50 years now, 50 years since it's been approved, over 51. The cool thing they found out when this prefrontal cortex activates is that something called neuroplasticity comes back online. So I'm sure we've all heard of this, neurons that fire together, wire together, the biological basis of habit. The more we use certain brain regions, the more blood flow they get, the denser the gray and the white matter become in those brain areas. So if someone here plays piano, for example, any piano players? There, Wayne, I've seen put his hand up there. So if I were to open up Wayne's skull and look at the part of his brain to do with hand-to-eye coordination, I don't know where it is, but let's say it's there, that part of his brain would literally be thicker than the same part of the brain in my head. So neuroplasticity is not it's not simply psychological, it is physiological. It makes physical changes to the brain. Once you become lucid, neuroplasticity comes back online, meaning that whatever you do in the lucid dream is actually creating neural pathways in the brain, often novel, new neural pathways in the brain, which leads us to be able to make audacious statements like through lucid dreaming, you can rewire your brain while you sleep. It is true. They've done studies on athletes. They found that when they become lucid, if they practice their athletic discipline, they actually get better at that athletic discipline in the waking state. You can literally learn through lucid dreaming. People say, oh, but dreaming is about learning anyway. Now, dreaming is about reconsolidation of memory. So if you're learning to do something in the day, really important to dream about it at night because that helps to reconsolidate the memory of something you did. Lucid dreaming allows you to learn novel action. So you can practice something in the lucid dream you've never done before, and you will get better at it through training in the lucid dream. This is nuts. This is the sci-fi bit, right? Where you're like, this is nuts. Have you heard of lucid dreaming? So once you become lucid, although the mind knows you are asleep, the brain thinks you're awake, and it will start to lay down neural pathways in exactly that the same way it does in the waking state. So imagine if you do your spiritual practice in the lucid dream. Imagine if you do your meditation in the lucid dream. What a powerful impact on your neurology that can have. And to go from neuroscience to Budo science, let's look at where this sits within Tibetan Buddhism. Well, within Buddhism itself. Okay. So the school of Buddhism that has lucid dreaming and what's called dream yoga practice, Milam Naljor, dream yoga practice, most centrally is Tibetan Buddhism or Vajrayana, the form of Buddhism that flourished mainly in the Himalayan regions about 1,000 years ago. But you can actually find references to lucid dreaming way back to the time of Buddha himself. So in the Pali Vinaya, which is kind of like the rule book for monks and nuns, you find, I wish there was a line which said Buddha says, do lucid dreaming. You can't find that line, but you can find a line where Buddha advises his monks to fall asleep in a state of mindfulness. And you think, okay, nice line, but is he talking about lucid dreaming? If you kind of look at why he's answering that question, it's to avoid nightmares and to avoid dreams of omission. Very interesting. We now have loads of science of how great lucid dreaming is for treating nightmares. Because if you can train someone to become lucid in their nightmare and go, oh, I'm not really being, chased by an axe murderer, I'm just dreaming about it. And actually, this axe murderer is part of my mind, some monstrous, traumatized part of my mind, which is trying to get my attention. Maybe rather than running, I should run towards them and look to integration. So could it be that Buddha, 2,500 years ago, was pointing towards lucid dreaming as a tool for nightmares, perhaps? And the next bit is dreams of omission. This one's quite funny. So this is actually still part of the Vinaya right now. So monks and nuns still have to apply this in modern society. If you have a non-lucid dream that you have sex and you have taken a vow of celibacy, you have not broken your vow of celibacy because it was non-lucid. There was not conscious, cognizant awareness of the act you were engaging in. However, and any monks and nuns, any monastics who might be online now, be aware, if you become lucid and you know what you're doing, I'm in a lucid dream, I'm consciously aware, and then you break your vow of celibacy, you have broken the vow and you need to confess it and do a gazillion prostrations and all this kind of stuff, right? So it seems like we can find some references to lucid dreaming going all the way back to the time of Buddha, but it's in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition that you find it most prevalently taught. And there's this tradition going back at least 1,000 years in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. What was it used for? Why was lucid dream training used in this old craft? Primarily, it was used for training for the moment of death. So this was a death practice originally, and still is. The idea being that the bardo, the intermediate state that we enter into after we have died, and the gross corporeal form, sorry, the mind stream is separated from the gross corporeal form at the point of death, and we enter into this dreamlike state, not a dream, but dreamlike state for up to 49 days, this famous kind of 49-day transitional period. It's said that the bardo state, or a lot of the bardo, the third part of the bardo, is dreamlike and hallucinatory. And that if you want to know what your experience of the after-death bardo will be like, look at how your experience of sleep and dream is. To quote my teacher, if you want to know how you will die, look at how you fall asleep and look at how you dream. If you can fall asleep consciously, then you are training yourself to die consciously. And if you can recognize dreams with full lucidity, you are training the mind to recognize the after-death apparitions with full lucidity. And he says, and then you can be with Buddha, which kind of can lead to this kind of full enlightenment experience. So Lucid dreaming is not a kind of a left field practice in Tibetan Buddhism. It is formed a central part of the 3 or 4 year retreats for at least a few hundred years now. And if you talk to a Tibetan Lama about your dreams, they often kind of glaze over our dream. Everyone's had a dream about having tea with the Dalai Lama, right? They look a bit bored. Talk to them about your lucid dreams, your dreams of recognition is the term. Then they'll sit upright, because it's quite rare for Westerners to have that training. And whether you have the training or not, if you can recognize your dreams, it's a very powerful practice to have, because you're training for the moment of death. It's also used in a very utilitarian fashion to do your spiritual practice while you sleep, because one of the unique facets of Vajrayana Buddhism in comparison to Theravada and other forms of Mahayana was this idea of enlightenment in one lifetime. You know, of course, enlightenment is possible for all of us. It's a major tenet of Buddhism, but it takes many lifetimes, of course. In Vajrayana, it said, actually, you can do it in one lifetime, which is an audacious claim. Audacious. It can happen in one lifetime, but you can't be asleep for a third of it. Or if you are asleep, you need to be consciously asleep. So it formed part of Vajrayana because you had to be practicing in your sleep. So we have the falling asleep consciously practices, which is like a form of Tibetan Buddhist yoga nidra. We have the lucid dreaming practices, the dream yoga practices, which is a form of Tibetan Buddhist lucid dreaming. And then we have the clear light of sleep practices, which doesn't really have a reference point in Western psychology or Western science, but it would be the equivalent of being fully conscious within deep delta wave sleep, which modern day science says is currently impossible. But there is a research team in Italy who are trying to prove this at the moment. So lucid dreaming is a powerful practice for Dharma practitioners. Oh, sorry, how am I doing on time? Am I over 30 minutes?
Yeah, Charlie, I was just about to interrupt you. I didn't want to because it's so interesting.
Sure, let me wrap it
Yeah,
up
so we're
now.
22, and then there are some questions in the chat, actually.
Okay, perfect. Let me just wrap this up and then we'll go
Sure,
straight to
no
questions, if that's
problem.
okay. Thanks, Caroline. So yeah, preparation for death, spiritual practice while we sleep, exploration of emptiness. This is a really powerful practice. And I think for any practitioner of Dharma, even not the whether it's the Buddha Dharma or some other form of Dharma, anyone who is engaging mind training, look at how you can train your mind in your sleep. Because I can't see any practice that is more relevant for today's world when we feel that we don't have time for our practice than dream yoga, lucid dreaming, because you literally do it in your sleep. You know, however busy we are, we probably go to sleep at night. And if there was a spiritual practice you could do in your sleep, seeped deep in Buddhist tradition, incredibly powerful, preparation for enlightenment, preparation for death, and also the most fun you can have in your pajamas, why wouldn't we do it? So there you go. There's my 30 minutes on why I think lucid dreaming is great. And now, please, let's have questions. No such thing as a silly question. My job has been to communicate. So if I have not communicated ideas sufficiently well, it is always my fault and not yours. So please do pick into this. Ask questions, challenge, debate. This is what we're here for.
Charlie,
Oh, and then after this Q&A, then we'll do a guided meditation too.
there are quite a few questions in the chat already. If you want to take a look, kind of
Sure.
the last five or six posts, maybe seven, are all questions.
Okay, here's one that's relevant for quite a few people from Victoria. I'm experiencing high stress at the moment. I've lost my ability to recall my dreams. Does that mean I'll not be able to experience lucid dreaming? Dream recall is one of the kind of foundation stones of lucid dreaming. It's not to say you can't have lucid dreams unless you recall your dreams. You can absolutely still have spontaneous lucid dreams. Like you might have a lucid dream tonight after this talk, even though you haven't been able to recall your dreams, you know, recently. Absolutely. Like at the moment, my dream recall is terrible. I've got a 10-month-old baby. So I used to have this wonderful process of waking up in the morning, reaching my dream diary, writing it down, looking at all the symbols, checking my. Now I wake up from crying. And there's this like buffer zone of needing to get the baby within a certain amount of time before she starts freaking out. Like my dream recall done, but I'm still having quite a few lucid dreams because of all those sleep disruptions that are coming from being a new dad. So it's definitely possible. I think to have a lucid dream practice, like a stabilized practice, then yeah, dream recall is quite important. But I think the first part of your question is most important. You're experiencing higher stress at the moment, so let's look at that. Maybe look at ways to help reduce your stress, to help integrate your stress, which may not be lucid dreaming. Maybe things like yoga nidra, maybe the practice we're about to do in 20 minutes or so will really help with mitigating some of that stress. Lucid dreaming is going to be there in a few weeks, a few months, whenever this period of high stress in your life decreases. So maybe it's not the perfect time to start, and that's totally fine. I've actually got a book actually just about kind of stress-affected sleep, wake up to sleep. Has got a little bit of lucid dreaming in it, but mainly it's breath work and yoga nidra and deep relaxation practices for stress-affected sleep. So maybe that'd be something to check out before you look at the lucid dreaming. Oh, another interesting one. Folks with sleep apnea who don't spend much time in REM, will they still be able to have lucid dreams? Yes. Definitely. And I know this because I once did a retreat in Joshua Tree with the Nine Gates Mystery School, where a lot of people in this retreat were much older than me. There were like at least a few octogenarians, a lot of people in their 70s, quite a few people in their 80s, and a lot of people had CPAP machines. And I do these lucid dreaming retreats. I've got one in May actually coming up in Glastonbury if anyone wants to join. There's still a few places. And in the first half of the night, people sleep in their rooms, like let's say 10:30 till 4 in the morning. And then if you want, from 4 in the morning onwards, you leave the comfort of your bedroom and you come and it back into the sacred sleeping area, basically the workshop space, the shrine room, where you have bed number two set up, kind of a camping bed set up. And then I will guide you into the practice, let you sleep for a couple of hours, wake you up, then guide you in again. You have kind of several of these sessions. And from 4 a.m., we had a lot of people bringing CPAP machines in with them. And there was like about a dozen at one point. And yeah, it was kind of noisy and people were struggling to sleep and stuff like that, but we still had lucid dreams. Absolutely. I think it might make it more difficult if you have sleep apnea, especially if you're using a CPAP machine or some sort of master sleep. But the power of your intention, the power of your mind is way more powerful than any obstacle the body can give us. So it's definitely possible, I can say that. Oh, good question from oh, there's a Kate Morley, Kate Mordy. For those who experience dissociation or depersonalization, like derealization, can lucid dreaming be a risk? Very interesting. If somebody was really deep in a period of psychosis, I would not advise them to try lucid dreaming at that time. However, whether I advise them or not, there seems to be a barrier for entry naturally built into lucid dreaming. Because the fundamental tenet of lucid dreaming is being able to tell the difference between internally generated hallucinations that appear to be real and the reality of the dream, actually, people who are experiencing derealization in the waking state will find it very hard to recognize their dreams at night. So, actually, it's very difficult for someone currently in psychosis to have lucid dreams. So, there seems to be kind of a barrier to entry there. But I would advise if someone was like actually in psychosis that they try some of the kind of more relaxation techniques, the sleep techniques before they move on to lucid dreaming. However, lucid dreaming can be a very good healing tool for those who have experienced psychosis and derealization. So once you are out of it can be a very good way to restabilize afterwards. And actually, I think it can be very good preventative medicine before someone has experienced psychosis or derealization. In fact, a few years ago, I had a lot of people who were training to be training with the Psychedelic Society to be psychedelic therapists coming to my retreats and workshops. And their logic for doing so made perfect sense to me. It was this. One of the main reasons that people have a so-called bad trip is that when the visions appear from ayahuasca or mushrooms, whatever they're taking, they don't see them as projections of their mind taking symbolic form, but see them as externally existing and real. And this can lead to this kind of panic that, like, I've kind of unleashed some demon or something. So their idea was that if you could train people in lucid dreaming before they had an ayahuasca experience or a big kind of medicine dose, you're actually training their mind perfectly for that experience. Because a lucid dreamer's main tool is knowing the difference between internally generated hallucination and reality. So I thought it was a very good preparation for that. And I think not just preparation for psychedelics, but preparation for psychosis. No one knows the difference between reality and dream better than a lucid dreamer. And for people and for myself, who's experienced psychosis as a much younger person, that's what goes. When psychosis looms, it's not being able to tell the difference. So lucid dreaming actually prepares us very well for it. Yeah, great question. That's a good one from Anne. I feel some resistance to trying lucid dreaming because my dreams can be so weird. The thought of interacting with the strange and sometimes scary dream carriers feels a daunting process. Yet I sense its potential. Great question. Yeah, absolutely. And the odd joke I often give with the when I'm teaching kind of Dharma people or spiritual practitioners is a lucid dream, you're going to see yourself as you really are. You know, we can do a lot of practice in the waking state. We do a lot of Dharma, all this kind of stuff. And we think we're pretty sorted, right? And then you have your first lucid dream and it's some sexualized zombie apocalypse or something like that. And you're like, oh my God, this can't be me. I'm a Buddhist. You know, surely my mind must be full of purity and all this kind of stuff. And you realize actually being in a zombie apocalypse in your lucid dream is not a sexualized zombie apocalypse, in fact, is not a bad thing at all. You know, if I became lucid in a dream where I'm just sunbathing on the beach, not a lot to do, not a lot of shadows to be integrated. But if I become lucid in a dream that's like really violent or highly sexualized or something, I go, ah, brilliant. Thank you, dreamer, for making me lucid in a dream where there is such potential for transformation. There's such work to be done. There's so much love that I can give to these wounded parts of myself. For what is a monster that we meet in our dreams, but a wounded part of ourselves? How do we become monstrous? Trauma monsteritizes us. So actually, I pray that you become lucid in those dreams that are very weird and possibly quite scary. And I pray also that when you become lucid in those dreams, that you don't turn your back on those parts of you. And also you don't see them as separate from you. You know, when people become lucid and they meet angelic beings, they're very easy to say, oh, it was my inner angel. It was symbolic representation of my inner archetype of the angel. When they meet their inner demons, ooh, much harder to own that. And much more likely, so, oh, it must have been a dark shaman entered my dream. Oh, that was the collective unconscious. Oh, was it? The other was I was person, but that particular bit was the collective? Maybe. Even if it was from the collective, the same rules apply. You know, if the collective shadow enters your dream, still show it love. Love is the most powerful force in the universe. We're Dharma practitioners, we know that. Do we? I hope we know that. Let's try and know that, I think I should have said. So we still show love to whatever appears in the dream, whatever appears. You know, love is the most powerful antidote there. Oh, good TED talk on that. Actually, the first TED talk I gave that 10 years or so ago is all about that, like loving those wounded parts of yourself in the lucid dream. Great question. Feel free, Caroline, if you're seeing any questions I'm missing that sound good.
I'm losing track a little bit just because I'm responding to people as well.
Oh,
So,
no probs. I got
but
you. I
yeah.
got you. Okay. God, Owen, your question is beyond my pay grade, but I'll share it. It sounds so fascinating question. As a person who's interested in predictive processing, which is a theory of consciousness that posits that our experience is based in sense memory and expectation. In essence, our reality is a controlled hallucination and thus not fully out there. How close is this to the Buddhist concept of emptiness? I don't know. But I bet if you are someone with wisdom, someone who's done loads of retreat and who's really trained their mind far beyond my capacity, they'll give you a great answer. So please, I'm not being flippant. I mean, really do ask that question to a meditation master, because I'd love to know the answer, but I can't give you one. Okay, this is the second time someone's mentioned sleep paralysis. So let's look at this. Okay. I was avoiding the first one. I thought if it comes up again, I'll do it. Sleep paralysis. Has anybody had the experience of waking up in the morning and you wake up, your eyes are open or they seem to be open, and you're paralyzed in your bed like that? Then you might have these weird kind of rushing sounds. You might have a figure at the end of the bed. You kind of start hallucinating, feeling of doom. Anyone had that show of hands? Okay, few hands going. This is sleep paralysis. Okay. Well, first things first, it could be a demon at the end of your bed. You know, let's acknowledge that. Who am I to say it's not? Could be a demon at the end of your bed. Careful of those demons. Personally, I want to offer you a different perspective that is maybe more palatable than there's a demon at the end of my bed. When you enter REM, rapid eye movement, dreaming sleep, there are these three REM requisites. So, several things happen to the brain, right? Like your eyes start flicking, the rapid eye movement, you start dreaming. One of the main things happens, you become paralyzed. So whenever you dream, you're paralyzed. You're not paralyzed in other forms of sleep, which is why you can sleepwalk, of course. And sleepwalking does not happen in dreaming. It happens in deep sleep and the non-REM waves of sleep. But when you're in REM, when you're dreaming, your body's paralyzed. It's kind of like a safety mechanism to stop you running around the bedroom. You might still kind of flick out and make little movements, but you're not going to be running around the bedroom, right? You're paralyzed. The pons, actually, part of the brain there, send a signal to the major muscle groups to paralyze you. Usually when you wake up, this paralysis mechanism switches off. Your brain stops dreaming. So cortical activation with creating dreaming switches off and you start taking in external data and you're basically awake, right? And it happens, boom, like that. But sometimes when you wake up, sometimes due to stress, sometimes due to jet lag, if you kind of messed up your sleep cycle, a lot due to recreational drugs. Like when it's festival season in the UK, every weekend I'm getting people kind of emailing me about sleep paralysis and stuff. And it's probably because they got on it a couple of weeks beforehand. So recreational drugs will do it. Genetics will do it. Some people are genetically predisposed to it. And sometimes it just happens. You wake up in the morning, cortical activation is disengaged. So basically, rather than the brain creating internally generated hallucination that we call dream, the brain switches on. So you're now kind of looking around your bedroom. But the paralysis mechanism stays engaged. So you're now in your bed, you're seemingly awake, but you're paralyzed like that. Then, because your brain loves you and is always trying to help, your brain goes, oh, we're still paralyzed. And we were paralyzed a minute ago and dreaming. So maybe I'm still supposed to be dreaming. So your brain will now start dreaming with your eyes open. And if you start dreaming with your eyes open, we call it psychotic hallucination. If you look at someone having a psychotic hallucination, you put them into a brain scan, what parts of the brain are lit up? Occipital lobe, visual cortex. They're dreaming with their eyes awake, which is a footnote here, which is why it's such a bad idea in most cases to tell a psychotic person that their psychosis is not real. It's as real as your dreams. And I bet you've had a dream where you could taste something, where you fell in love in a dream, where you experienced something amazing in a dream. So to tell someone it's not real is someone's unhelpful. I find the most helpful thing when working with people in psychosis, and both my parents had advanced Alzheimer's where they entered into psychosis for long periods, is to enter into the dream with them. You know, become lucid in their psychosis. Okay, so for you, this is what you're seeing. How does that feel for you? How can I help you in this situation? Anyway. So you're paralyzed in bed, the brain's trying to help you, so it starts hallucinating. This is the crux of it. Why is it scary? It doesn't have to be. The hallucinations that your brain projects outwardly will be dependent on the internal environment of your mind. The internally generated hallucination that your brain will project outwardly are dependent on the internal environment of your mind, which in most cases is, oh fuck, oh, I'm really scared because I'm paralyzed, right? So it's scary things. And it's completely culturally specific. You can, it's a really interesting book looking at sleep paralysis in various cultures. Very interesting theory on alien abductions and why there were so many of these alien abductions in a certain place. Often truckers who've been driving all night, taking PET pills, amphetamines to keep themselves awake, then they'd fall asleep and they'd have the aliens at the end of their bed and stuff. Interesting cultural phenomenon. Although some woman at a workshop once asked me, how can you prove to me that the aliens aren't waiting for you to have sleep paralysis before they abduct you? Touche. Great response. So usually it's something scary at the end of our bed, right? And sometimes you have these like l loud audio hallucinations. It's called oh, I can't remember what it's called. It's basically because your hearing switching on, so you become it, you can hear the blood rushing through your ears. It can make this kind of loud rushing noise. If, however, you were in that state and you were able essentially to think happy thoughts, to like make the internal environment of your mind one of love. That demon at the end of your bed, or the witch at the end of your bed, or the dark figure would literally become an angel. Another interesting cultural theory. So many people have visions of the Virgin Mary and Jesus when, after they've been asleep for a few hours, they wake up. The power of God, the power of God stuck me to the bedpost. You're like, oh, okay, they're having sleep paralysis, but they weren't seeing a demon, they were seeing an angel. And of course, all demons and angels are from our mind, right? This is what Milarepa said. So sleep paralysis, very weird. How does it relate to lucid dreaming? Kind of doesn't. When some people start training in lucid dreaming, they might find they have more sleep paralysis than usual because they're kind of disrupting their sleep cycles. In some of the techniques disrupt sleep cycles, not all of them. You can use it to have a lucid dream though, but it means doing something very paradoxical. It means focusing on the hallucination, whether it's angelic or demonic. Seemingly, focus on the hallucination because that hallucination is made of dreams. So if you kind of focus on it, you kind of draw your attention back into the dream and you kind of reverse back into the dream from which you came with often with full lucidity. So it can be a great way to have a lucid dream. But how do you get out of it? That's what you're thinking. How the hell do you get out of it? You need to engage the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the opposite of doing this. So you need to do this. Long exhale, like letting air out of a tire, sissing like a snake. You do that for a long, long exhale, and you will feel it click out in most cases, and you'll be awake in your bed. Good question. How long left for questions, Caroline? We need to hit the hour, right? And then we'll go into the guided meditation, I guess.
Yeah, so we'll be finishing at
Sure.
past. So if you want to do a half hour meditation, we yeah, that would be in a couple of
Sure.
minutes.
Okay, let's do a couple more questions. Carlos is saying, for as long as I can remember, the Hulk, I assume the kind of, the Incredible Hulk, the green-skinned monster guy, is after me, and he's so mad. I wonder now if this is a representation of the anger I carry within. I'm not here to interpret your dreams, Carlos, but yes, I wonder too. And I wonder if you could become lucid in that dream and finally turn around to that Hulk figure rather than running and go towards them and embrace them. That you could have a very powerful psychological integration that would probably lead to a very different relationship to anger that you have in the waking state. Who knows? That'd be my theory. How to become lucid if you have no dream body from Tyler. I think that's Tyler who I'm friends with on Instagram. Nice to see you here, bro. Most people dream in an embodied form. So most people have dreams that they kind of look down and they like have a body, they're doing stuff in a body. But sometimes people have dreams from a point of awareness. You ever had that where you're dreaming kind of like in third person? You're kind of watching something from above. You're not kind of in the dream in first person. How to get lucid if that happens? Interesting one. I mean, essentially, if you can use not having a body as a reality check, then you can get lucid. So if you it sounds kind of too simple to be true, but basically you go, where's my body? Well, I don't have a body. Oh, then I must be in a dream right now. So you can kind of use that kind of logical step of like, I don't have a body, so I must be dreaming and become lucid. But it sounds like you're saying, how can I lucid dream? Or no, how can I become lucid? I have a dream body. Yeah, then I would say that is the answer. In the Mexican Toltec tradition, they have a long lucid dream tradition going back about 1,000 years. So about as ancient as the Tibetans, they've been doing lucid dreaming. And they have this thing that is really important to actually, like the Tibetans, they have a thing that's really important to like have a dream body. So they will do practices in the day of consciously looking down at their body, like throughout the day, because you tend to dream about what you do in the daytime, right? So how often do we do this in the daytime? Just really become aware that we have a body. And read, actually, as Buddhists, you probably do this quite a lot if you meditation, but most people don't, right? So we don't dream in that way. But if you can spend time doing that, they do a lot of mirror practice where you look at yourself in the mirror and kind of change your reflection and stuff because you will start dreaming in that way. So some mirror work would be good, kind of looking down at your body in the day, maybe doing some somatic practice, stuff to get into your body, like whether it's Qigong, a soft martial art, or a hard martial art, or like physical activity, stuff that kind of gets into your body because you will dream about what you do in the day. So the more embodied you are in the day, the more embodied you will be in your dreams. Can aid generalized learning? This is from a 50-year-old who just started degree. Really brilliant, Claire. Wonderful, you just started a degree. Generalized learning, I mean, lucid dreaming is good for your brain. We know that. And we know that lucid dreamers, that's the interesting thing. You know how I said that part of your brain, whoever it was who was playing the piano, I said the part of their brain was bigger. They've actually found they've looked at lucid dreamers' brains. So people who have frequent lucid dreams, like, 3 to 5 lucid dreams a week consistently. That's like a high level. It's way more than I'm having at the moment. The part of their brain is actually bigger than non-lucid dreamers' brains because it gets so much more blood flow. And it's the part of the brain to do with out-of-the-box thinking, like lateral thinking. There's actually a part of your brain that does that. And that part of the brain is swollen or enlarged in regular lucid dreamers. Whether that can help with generalized learning, like if you're doing stuff like you need to learn to think outside the box, you need to kind of recognize patterns, stuff like that, lucid dreaming seems to be better at that. So it depends what your degree is in. I think, I mean, what you could do is whatever you're exploring in your degree, you could explore in the lucid dream. You know, if you're learning a new language, you can speak that language with your dream characters, and they will often speak that language far better than you because they are not limited by your conscious memory. They are the unconscious. So they have that book that you've read with all the French verbs in it or something, your unconscious remembers, even though your conscious doesn't. So there are ways you might be able to train in that, but I don't know. But good luck with the degree. Okay, folks, that's probably all we've got time for on the Q&A. So I wouldn't need the guided meditation. Oh, I need to mention dana and stuff. Yeah, so what is dana? Like, if you're into Buddhism and stuff, you probably come across this term. It's basically, it actually means like generosity. So Sunday Sangha do all these things for free, but obviously they need some way of like supporting themselves. So they ask for donations basically. So any donation that you give tonight, they give some to me, they take some, and it allows us to support ourselves. If you can't afford to give, that's totally fine. And please don't feel any pressure, and definitely don't log off now and miss the meditation because, oh, I can't afford to give a tenner, so I'm going to miss the meditation. Don't do that. Please absolutely stay. But if you have enjoyed it, then yeah, please donate, and it will help both me and Sangha Live support themselves. Okay, folks, so we're going to finish now with, oh, by the way, if you want to keep in touch, charliemorley.com, you'll find me on Instagram. Apparently, if you just put Charlie Lucid, all my stuff comes up. Retreats coming up. There's one in May in Glastonbury. There's still, I think, seven places left for that. So that'd be the one where if you want, you can come and sleep in the shrine room, and I'll wake you throughout the night and guide you into the practices. Kind of like lucid dreaming boot camp. And that's lucid dreaming with shadow work as well. So if you're interested in the Jungian concept of shadow integration, that's one to check out too. And everything's on my website. But in a moment, I'm going to encourage you, if you can, to lie down. And we're going to do a guided practice where the first part, I'll basically lead you into a guided yoga nidra. So we'll do kind of a body scan, generalized, a graduated relaxation. But then when we're in that state of conscious within the hypnagogic being the first state of the first stage of sleep, actually, I'm then going to ask you to repeat, if you like, certain affirmations which will encourage lucidity dawning tonight, certain affirmations to recognize your dreams tonight. If you don't want to engage those affirmations, then don't. Just hearing me saying them won't work anyway. So you won't be hypnotized into anything you don't want to be hypnotized into. But this is a form of deep relaxation where I'll then encourage you, once you're in that fertile ground of the hypnagogic, to engage some affirmations to have lucid dreams tonight. So yeah, take a moment to make yourself totally comfortable. I am just going to let Chloe and Nova know that I'm going to lead a meditation so that. So yeah, there's a 10-month-old. I don't think you can hear her this, but I got a new mic. Apparently, isn't it? People say they can't hear the baby now. Anyway, I'll just kind of let them know. Make yourself comfortable. You don't need to see the screen, but you do need to hear me. So you can have your cameras off. I'll turn my camera off. You just need to be able to hear my audio, and we'll begin in a couple of minutes. Okay, folks, so if you can be lying down, that's wonderful. If you would rather not be lying down and that you have any problems with lying down, then absolutely do this seated. Of course, in the Tibetan tradition, the majority of these sleep and dream practices were done on the 3 or 4 year retreat where you don't lie down for 4 years. You're upright for 16 hours a day meditating. Then at night, you're allowed to do this. Lean back in your chair, lean back in your meditation box. So, can you do this seated upright? Absolutely. But give yourself a gift of relaxation if you like, and allow yourself to lie down. The aim here is not to fall asleep, though. So don't be comfortable enough to be lying down for 25 minutes, but not so comfortable that you just instantly drift off to sleep. The aim is to stay consciously aware throughout. Often I set this to music, but we realize we might have a problem with copyright when we upload this to YouTube. So there won't be music, it'll just be my voice leading you. So before we begin, taking a moment to set our intention and motivation for this practice that we're about to engage in. Reminding ourselves that we engage this practice not only for ourselves, but for the benefit of all sentient beings, with the sincere aspiration that training our mind in the practice of sleep and dream yogas might help us to be more awake, more aware, and more kind in all our interactions, in our life, in our dreams, and our death. And so we set this intention to engage the practice for the benefit of all beings. Taking a moment to make yourself totally comfortable. If you could make yourself 10% more comfortable, I encourage you to make that change. Scratch that itch, loosen that belt, use that extra pillow, whatever you like. Allow yourself to be comfortable. Give yourself the gift of relaxation. And then, whenever you're ready, allowing your eyes to close if it feels safe to do so. When your eyes close, just allowing yourself to feel the support of the ground beneath you. Maybe the ground supporting you on your chair, or the ground supporting you on your bed, on your sofa, or on the floor. Just notice how the earth element, that ground, is supporting you. And allow yourself to release fully into the support of the ground. No need to hold your body up. For this meditation, allow it to really relax into the support of the ground. Even if you're sitting upright, allow yourself to relax into the support of the ground. And as we feel the support of the ground, we reset the support of our meditation, of our motivation. Setting the intention to stay mindfully aware for the full duration of this exercise, allowing ourselves to drift into that sleepy relaxation of the hypnagogic, but at all times, staying aware of my voice, being aware of our body as it lies in space. The aim is not to black out. The aim is not to fall asleep. The aim is to stay consciously aware in the deeply relaxing shallows of the hypnagogic state. Ask you now to bring attention to your body. Bring your attention to the contact points of your body with the ground beneath it. If you're on a chair, your feet on the ground, your bum on the chair. If you're lying down, then the contact points of your heels, back of your legs, your bum, your back, your arms, the back of your head. Just notice the contact points of your body with the ground beneath you, and again, relax and release into the support of the ground. Now that you've connected to the ground through all those points of your body, allow yourself to relax into the support of the ground as you relax into the release of the out-breath. With each exhalation, allow yourself to drift deeper and deeper into the support of the ground. Breathing in, feeling the body expand, and breathing out, feeling the body release and relax. Breathing in, the body expands. Breathing out, the body releases into the support of the ground. Breathing in, the body expands. Breathing out, the body releases into the support of the ground. And now I invite you to let me guide you through a basic body scan, allowing our awareness to scan through our body, and with awareness comes relaxation. Beginning at our feet, put your attention into your feet. Really feel into your feet. Feel into each one of your toes, the sole of your foot, the top of your foot. See if you can put your mind into your feet. Perhaps you become aware of a pulse in one of your toes that you were not aware of before. Bring awareness into your feet. And with awareness comes relaxation. And from your feet, allow your awareness to flow up into your ankles, lower leg, calf muscles, knees, shins. And again, allow these parts of your legs to release and relax. Flowing up from your knees to your upper legs, your thighs, your buttocks, your groin area, all the way up to the level of your hips. Really feel into your legs, from the tips of your toes to the level of your hips. Put your mind into your legs. And from your hips, allowing awareness to flow up through the core of your body, kidneys, abdominals, lower back, middle back, lower ribs, all the way up to the level of your armpits. Become aware of the core of your body. Awareness now flowing from the tips of your toes all the way up to the level of your armpits. And with awareness comes relaxation. Maintaining that point of awareness at the level of your armpits, bringing your mind now into your hands. Really feeling into your hands, each one of your fingers and thumbs. And just releasing any of the tension that you might be holding in your hands. Awareness flowing up from the hands to the wrists, forearms, elbows, flowing up into the upper arms, biceps, triceps, shoulders. Meeting that point of awareness at the level of your armpits and sweeping around through your collarbones, your upper back, your shoulders, your clavicle, all the way to the base of your neck. Allowing yourself to be aware now from the tips of your toes to the base of your neck, and with awareness comes relaxation. That deep relaxation of awareness. And from the base of your neck, the awareness flows up through your throat, your neck, the back of your head, under your chin, your mouth, your face, your ears, the back of your head, your forehead, eyes, top of the head, crown of the head. Aware now of your entire body as it lies in space, from the tips of your toes to the crown of your head. And now, as a way to charge up our awareness before we engage our affirmations of lucidity, I invite you now to bring your focus to the point between your eyebrows. Gather your focus at the point between your eyebrows. And if you can, imagine a ball of white light at this point between your eyebrows. Or imagine a full moon, if that's easier. Imagine a ball of white light or a bright full moon at the point between your eyebrows and allow your awareness to gather in to this ball of light. Allow your awareness to gather in one pointedly to this ball of light at the point of your eyebrows and maintain that focus. Maintain that focus. Maintain that focus. And release and relax. Allowing yourself now to drop any focus of awareness around your body. Drop any visualization of the ball of white light. And allow yourself to rest in the deep relaxation of the hypnagogic state. And now that we've given every part of our body the gift of awareness, and now that we've heightened our awareness, heightened our concentration through this visualization at the third eye center, we are in the perfect place to engage our affirmations of lucidity. In your own way, in your own mind, I invite you to repeat the following affirmations after me. The next time I'm dreaming, I recognize that I'm dreaming. The next time I'm dreaming, I recognize that I'm dreaming. The next time I'm dreaming, I recognize that I'm dreaming. Continue that affirmation in your own mind at your own pace for the next couple of minutes. And when your mind drifts off, as it naturally will, with a smile, just bring it back to the affirmations at hand. The next time I'm dreaming, I recognize that I'm dreaming. The next time I'm dreaming, I recognize that I'm dreaming. The next time I'm dreaming, I recognize that I'm dreaming. Continue at your own pace for the next couple of minutes. And again, when your mind drifts off into non-lucid sleep, just bring it back to the sound of my voice, reminding yourself of your intention and stabilizing that intention through repeating the affirmation. The next time I'm dreaming, I recognize that I'm dreaming. The next time I'm dreaming, I recognize that I'm dreaming. The next time I'm dreaming, I recognize that I'm dreaming. Continue at your own pace, in your own mind, for the next couple of minutes. And then allowing that affirmation to pass through your mind. I invite you now to drop the affirmation. And for the next few minutes, allow yourself to drift deeper into this state. If you fall asleep, that's totally fine. And maybe that's what your body needs. But if you can, see if you can drift deeper into this state while maintaining fully conscious awareness. If your awareness dips or drops, the sound of my voice will bring you back from wherever you go. But for the next few minutes, have the confidence to try. Allow yourself to drift deeper into this space while maintaining fully conscious awareness. And then, with no sense of rush, bringing yourself back to an awareness of my voice, an awareness of your body, an awareness of the room. Allowing yourself to stretch into your body if it feels good to do so. Wriggling your toes, stretching your arms, opening your eyes, bringing yourself back to fully wakeful awareness, feeling refreshed and rejuvenated and charged with the lucidity that will flow into your next sleeping session. We take a moment to dedicate any and all of the beneficial energy we may have generated in this practice and in our time here tonight, not only to ourselves, but to all sentient beings, with the sincere aspiration that these practices might help us to be more awake, more aware, and more kind for the benefit of all beings.